The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This evening I'd like to talk about six Buddhist practices that are not so often talked about in Western Theravada circles, Western Dharma circles, Insight circles. They're called the six recollections. And they're kind of more like contemplations, contemplative, where it's bringing to mind particular themes and then contemplating or reflecting, recollecting these themes as a way of developing one's inner life. And the way that Buddhism has tended to come into the modern Western world has tended to come for people who are not so interested in the religious side of Buddhism and are interested in a kind of a direct pointing or direct kind of get to the point kind of approach. So the get to the point, you know, so people think that meditation is like the highest, the best thing you could do. And so, you know, all the preliminary preparations for meditation, you know, that's not for me. I'll jump in to the deep end. And in Asia, in Thailand and Burma, often a meditation is considered something that you would get to eventually after you've prepared yourself. And one of the primary preparations is to get your ethical life together. Now, if I offered a course here at IMC, a 5-week, 6-week introductory course on ethics, I suspect that I'd get considerably fewer people than what we get when I offer a 5-6-week class introduction to meditation because of people's interest. But ethics are a very important part of the foundation for allows a person to really settle deeply, have the kind of inner sense of goodness and relaxation that allows for the deeper practice of meditation. And so there's a series of practices they have in Asia that tend not to be focused on in the West. And so the six recollections are one of these. So they're avoided partly because they're more religious, seemingly, and partly because they seen as kind of extra, not really to the heart of the matter, the important thing. We want to get to the important thing. And also, perhaps, they're not focused on so much here in the West, because many of us who are interested in Dharma and practice here in the West, I think, tend to have kind of an intellectual bent, like to read books or now listen to talks, ideas. The ideas seem really great. And perhaps it makes some sense to a culture for whom Buddhism is something new for them, that the ideas is the entryway into Buddhism. The idea of faith wouldn't be an entryway because it takes a lot of familiarity to have faith in some of the sacred concepts that Buddhism has to offer. And so, you know, if you're just bumbling into it somehow, it's hard to have that faith. So the six recollections are six contemplations around these themes: the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, virtue, generosity, and devas, gods. And one of the ways of thinking about these six recollections is that, well, first of all, when the Buddha kind of suggested these, I haven't gone back and actually read carefully all the places where he suggests this, but you might want to keep in mind that this is a practice the Buddha recommended, but perhaps he recommended it to particular people, so that these were suitable for certain people, maybe not for everybody. And so these might not be suitable for you, all of you, but maybe for some of you, or maybe suitable for some of you at some times. So, for example, sometimes these six recollections, or some of them, are given when a person gets close to death. Sometimes when you're dying, it's hard to, you know, meditate in the usual way. You can't sit up straight. It's hard to focus and concentrate the mind. But what is it that gets your attention and holds your attention in an important and useful way when you're approaching death, when there's a crisis or something? And so these six recollections sometimes can do that for people, especially if you're familiar with these themes. I like to think of these, for myself, I think of these six themes as speaking to the heart, that they touch the heart. So rather than being the intellectual side of Buddhism, rather than being about, you know, using your mind to focus and get attentive or be in the present moment or try to, you know, maneuver your way through life, they're ways of somehow opening up the heart or softening the heart or settling the heart. It's maybe perhaps a way of, you know, I don't know if love is the right expression that comes through with devotion or faith or the heartfelt qualities. And for some people, the opening, the path of the heart is much more powerful than the path of the mind. And the Buddha, when he talked about these six recollections, he didn't say they were about the heart, but that's my idea. But he did talk about how these recollections can lead a person to the first stage, the stream entry, the first stage of awakening, of freedom. When I was introduced to Vipassana in Asia, the whole focus there in the meditation retreats was to reach the first stage of awakening. But it was all kind of understood, you do it through meditation. But if you go back and look at the suttas, what the Buddha talked about, the first stage of awakening was reached when there's a very significant unshakable faith that's established in a person. Unshakable faith in the practice, unshakable faith in the path, unshakable faith in the people who teach the path or the teachings that come with the path. But that unshakableness is not just a light thing, it's a kind of radical transformation of the heart of the mind, so that we orient our life now in a new way from the way we used to orient it, which maybe wasn't so useful. So the first stage of, you know, awakening is this radical reorientation. And it said that these six recollections can create in a person that radical reorientation, the radical transformation. And so when I think of these six, I think of them as, for me at least, you know, they speak to the heart. And in speaking to the heart, maybe it's kind of like mirror neurons, you know, that the empathy, the way, you know, that we have other ways of understanding than through words and ideas and the mind figuring out and thinking. That there's ways of understanding that are, you know, more emotionally based, or more they resonate with the body or resonate with the emotional centers in our body. And it isn't that, you know, it's just emotional. It isn't that those places are unreliable. They might be very reliable if they resonate with the right place in us. If they resonate with that possibility we have for a inner purity, possibility we have inside for inner peace, inner settledness and relaxation, that place inside, that resonates with that place inside where we put down the burdens we carry in our lives. The burdens, you know, all kinds, anxiety and fears and family dramas and concerns about the future and past grievances, and there's so much burdens people carry. And so sometimes you can see something or something in the world can resonate and you can feel, yeah, I can drop those burdens. I can see that peace. I can feel it. When I went to practice in Japan, I would go and visit a lot of the Buddha, because Japan is a Buddhist country, there's a lot of Buddha statues everywhere. So I spent a lot of time looking at Buddha statues. And I found for me that some of these statues were dead, had nothing, no liveness to it. It's like any art, right? It had no art, some art maybe. But some of it spoke to me. And usually when a Buddha statue spoke to me, like resonated with something, it was... usually my eyes didn't fall on the face of the Buddha, but on the chest. And I think it's because of my breath in meditation. So there was something about the chest that somehow came, that brought to life or resonated with what I felt with when I'm deeply connected and settled on breathing when I sit and meditate. Or I went to a Japanese, in Kyoto, I went to Daitokuji. They have a sub-temple there, a small sub-temple, that had very small, these rock gardens, Zen rock gardens. And the distance was maybe from, I don't know, it was pretty small. Maybe it was only about 4 or 5 feet wide, and I don't know, 20 or 25 feet long. And you go through this little temple, and you come out on a little porch, little deck. I came out there and I looked down at the garden, and the garden was had been made 500-600 years earlier. So it's a really long old one. They rake it every day, but the garden itself was ancient. And there were these big rocks, the unmovable rock that had been placed in different locations, and then around those big rocks, spread out here and there, they had raked around, you know. And I was stunned when I sat and looked at this, and I was so moved by it that I sat down and just spent, I don't know how long, considerable amount of time, half an hour maybe or something, just looking and meditating on this art and this I saw there. Because what I couldn't believe was some artist with rocks and gravel 400 years ago had captured my breath in meditation. Such an ephemeral thing, my breath, you know, how I feel. The feeling I had when I was concentrated and settled and with my breathing was expressed in that rock garden. So, you know, so that's hard to believe. It's still hard to believe in telling you. How could that be? But I was so... And then I got up, and somewhere I saw a plaque. And on the plaque, it had the title of the art of the garden. And the title was In-Breath and Out-Breath. So the idea that some things resonate with us, and some people perhaps the some things resonate more than others. Perhaps some people have different mechanisms or ways in which they learn and know and understand. Some people it's more through words and ideas. Some people more through images. Some people maybe more kinesthetically through their bodies. So maybe it's some differences also from between people. But I think most people, I think, have some sense that sometimes something speaks to their hearts. So these six recollections. So the first one is to recollect the Buddha. And now I think that for someone coming off the street and never heard of the Buddha, perhaps it's not going to mean much. But for me, having been around Buddhism for a long time, and more importantly, having practiced for a long time, when I contemplate the Buddha, I refer back kind of automatically to some of the deepest experiences of peace, of purity, of well-being, of joy that I've experienced. And I've reached the end of or the fullness of what that's possible. But when I read about the Buddha, when I read what he accomplished, the teachings that he put together, what he came to understand, and the more I study them and the more I practice myself, the more amazed I am how much this one person discovered. It's quite remarkable. And how much this one person discovered and was able to systematize it and put it together in such a way that it was able to be passed on into the future. And he was able to understand something which in my Western rational, if it is, rational mind, makes so much sense. It's remarkable that he was able to present a path of transformation, a path of finding peace in life that has no, or virtually no, supernatural elements, supernatural beliefs, that this particular rational atheist speaks to, is meaningful, and is moving, and has moved me. And to read little bit the accounts of his life, how he lived his life. How this is a person who chose to walk away from security, to walk away from the career expectations that people had for him, the expectations that his family had for him. Some people are troubled that he walked away from his family, from his own family, his own child, and that's a whole topic in itself. But he did, at some point when his son was seven, become the primary parent for his son. So it was a temporary stepping away from his family. And and then to be willing to live a life of this radical simplicity. And so it speaks to me, at least, in my heart, someone who is at home in themselves, or at home in this world, at peace, in a life that's very, very simple, that's very connected to nature. He spent much of his time living in the woods. It seems like it wasn't necessarily wild woods. There's often groves and woods that were on the edge of towns. But still, it's pretty nice to live in parks and groves and woods and live at the base of trees. And it's beautiful. But it also represents kind of simplicity, you know, how simple it can be to be a human being, how simple it is to find peace and well-being. You don't need a lot of stuff to be happy. You don't need a lot of activities to be happy. And many people, I'm sure you're familiar with people here in the West, who have gotten the contagious bug of doing and acquiring as much as possible and staying busy and, you know, the frenetic everything and always staying connected. And so for the Buddha, what touches my heart is this person who experienced a peace, a joy, that's certainly greater than I've experienced so far, but did it in a way that felt very attuned to a simple life in nature, a simple life of being a human being, sitting on the earth, sitting in this planet. And then had the care and made the effort to offer his teachings to many, many, many people. For 45 years, he walked around his area of India, and he spent a tremendous amount of time being available to people. It doesn't seem, if you go back in the suttas, it doesn't seem like he spent a lot of time self-consciously teaching. It doesn't seem like he spent a lot of time, you know, writing down notes for a Dharma talk. But he was just available, and he'd run into people, and he would have conversations with people, and in those conversations, the Dharma was transmitted, the teaching was transmitted. And this idea of being available and teaching and helping other people touches my heart that someone would do that. And so for me, when I recollect the Buddha, it does something to me certainly is comforting, but settles me, that relaxes me, that makes me feel yes, kind of a yes, yes for this life, yes for being here, yes, there's a way of being, yes for me too. If I can get caught up in all kinds of concerns, it's a reminder. It's so simple here. And then recollection of the Dharma. And the Dharma is sometimes said, the Dharma is visible here and now, is the little phrase. The Dharma is visible here and now. And so in what way is it visible here and now? I like it that it is visible here now because it's not esoteric, it's not hidden. It's not something that, you know, it's in some secret place but it's something you can see directly. So in what way can you see the Dharma directly? The answer to that question is given by the Buddha. He said, you can see the Dharma directly when you experience for yourself the absence of greed, hate, and delusion. That's where the Dharma is found. It's apparent here and now. And it's also said the Dharma invites inspection. So rather than the Dharma being an obligation, that thou shalt learn Dharma, live by the Dharma, the Dharma is Dharma doesn't care what you do. Except there's an invitation. You can come and check it out and find out if it's valuable for you. And for me, it speaks very much to my heart that there's no obligation. There's no heavy kind of religious tone to Buddhism that overlays that all of it and say that, you know, in order to be a good person or a worthy person or a right person or something, you have to follow Buddhism, or have to be religious in some way. Buddhism, as I see it, there is no one, because there's no God in Buddhism, there's no overarching paternal figure to judge you. And so the Dharma leaves you free. And to me, that's very meaningful, that the Dharma leaves you free. And what do you do with that freedom? Well, the Dharma does say, come and look. It's come look more deeply. But it doesn't say, come and look more deeply at books or strange, unusual teachings of religion that are hard to believe. But it says, come and look at how your own heart and mind works. Read the book in your heart. Read the book in yourself. And see what, and that's where the truths are found. And it's not so esoteric. It's not so strange. It's not so complex, what Buddhism is talking about. It's talking about the simplicity of not clinging, not grasping, not contracting. It's not easy to let go of the clinging and to open up. But the Dharma is something that's imminently available to you here and now. It's available here. That's the Dharma. And for me, that speaks to my heart. It inspires me. It moves me. I'm in love with that Dharma. Even when I can't practice it, I can't quite do it. Sometimes I don't think I understand it. I'm so inspired by this Dharma. It's really a simple, direct, and immediate, practical, available thing here in the heart, in ourselves. And so when I know that and reminded of that, something inside of me settles, relax. Something inside of me kind of falls away. There's a kind of a warmth and delight and joy that I feel with that. And then there's the third one is the recollection of the Sangha. And there's one place where that's described, or kind of one sutta where the Buddha's talking to one particular person, where instead of talking about the Sangha, he says it's the recollection of your good friends. Those people who have your best, your welfare in mind. That there are people who care about you. So for people who have, good friends, it's good to remember them and to let it resonate in your heart, open your heart to your friends. But also, the Sangha can also mean the good friends that you have, that you practice with, whether you're actually, conventionally good friends or not. I have a lot of people who, as I practice over the last 35 years, who... I never became good friends with them. Actually, I never would have chosen to have been friends with them. But we shared the space together. We practiced together. We were in the meditation halls together. They sat next to me in the hall. Or we worked together in the monasteries. And, our hearts opened to each other in that life. And this kind of feeling this heartful openness and connection to people who share the practice with has been very, very meaningful for me. It's also been very meaningful for me to have had teachers, to have teachers, and to have people who have been examples and models of what is possible in doing this practice and people who develop their integrity. You can feel that these are people you can trust, people who develop their ability to be present, and you can feel their ability to really meet you or merely be present in this life, and they're not distracted and scattered. To feel people who have a depth of kindness or compassion. And you can feel the strength of that as it develops. And the field people who you feel there's no pretense, there's no conceit that they're wrapped up in. They're not trying to prove themselves or show themselves to anybody. They're just happy and content in a, without needing to, what in Buddhism we call, wave the flag of conceit. They're just present. You can feel this kind of simplicity and joy and peace there. There's a variety of ways in which people can manifest their spiritual maturity. And it's been very meaningful for me to be around people like that. And something happens in my heart when I'm around them. Again, this relaxation, this subtleness, feeling at home, this love, this delight that happens. The fourth recollection is to spend time recollecting generosity. And the fourth one is integrity or virtue, sila. And ideally, you're recollecting your own, if it's worth recollecting. That you would start, and Buddhism puts a big emphasis on it's very good to act in ethical ways. Many people have noticed in the West don't give themselves much credit for acting ethically because they're so, have so much inner turmoil that somehow they've internalized this idea that they're fundamentally wrong. And it doesn't matter what you do because you're kind of, you were wrong before you ever did anything. And so, but in a Buddhist point of view is somewhat, you take inspiration and delight from the times you have lived with integrity. You nourish yourself with that. Don't waste a lot of time undermining yourself by getting caught up in all the ways you've had lack of integrity. Focus on your lack of integrity just enough to learn from it to do better, but not enough to let it weigh you down. And you can be nourished by your integrity. I know when I went to Thailand the first time to practice, I sat a long Vipassana retreat. And before that time, if I wasn't so conscious about ethics. It wasn't a big deal for me. And if someone asked me about the importance of ethics, I think my attitude was one that people who are ethical are kind of like goody-goodies or something, or it's kind of petty or kind of trite, or, I didn't have a lot of respect for it. And I wasn't, really unethical also. I think mostly because because of a lack of imagination. So I was saved by my lack of imagination. But, it wasn't so, I didn't think. But when for that first retreat, long retreat that I sat, I experienced a degree of inner purity that I'd never had before. And it brought me a lot of joy to feel this inside. And then I understood why people can feel joy and delight and be nourished by their integrity, by their inner purity, by their ability not to be pushed around by greed, hate, and delusion, and deceit, and all these things. And so, to be nourished by your own integrity, and sometimes in the Buddhism, there was one story where a murderer, the Buddha, sometimes you said, it doesn't matter all the times you did something bad in the past. It matters that from a certain date, you decided from now on, I'm not going to do that anymore. So then to be nourished by the integrity from that date. Because it counts for a lot. So one of the beautiful places to feel integrity is on meditation retreats. As a teacher, I am so moved by how much people try to be honest, kind, how much they try on retreats to act the best of what a person is comes out on retreats. I think partly because the function of retreats, meditation retreats, is not to get pushed around by your reactivity, not be caught by your caughtness, by your greed or your hate or your desires. And if you're trying not to be caught by your activity, you're going to be ethical because unethical activities are an expression of having been caught by something. So as people try not to be caught, the best of people come out. And I've had people, it's beautiful on retreat, where I have an interview with someone, and we have a discussion about their practice, what's going on, and then they'll, later in the day, they'll send me a note, or they'll come to me and say, I have to talk to you, or I have, because I need to apologize, because I didn't tell you the truth. I said, oh, what did you tell me? It'll be usually something very small. You know, I don't know what they'll say. They'll say, you know, oh, I don't know. But usually, you know, in conventional world, you wouldn't think it was such a big deal because conventional people exaggerate all the time. But on retreat, people are so sensitive to that. And so they feel off. They're off the fact that they exaggerated or they didn't quite get it right. And so they want to come. And I don't exactly feel a need for it, that they apologize usually. But it's so beautiful. I'm so moved that that's what they want to do. They want to make amends. They want to clean the slate. They want to, you know, clean the air and start over in a sense. It doesn't take much to reflect on how much better place the world would be if people were just a little bit more ethical overall. It's a beautiful quality to be a person that no one has to be afraid of, to go through the world and not be a source of fear for anybody. And if you can't be delighted in your own ethical integrity, then the ethical integrity of other people can be a source of delight, source of joy, source of love. It can be very meaningful. And or just the abstract idea, yes, human beings do have the capacity sometimes. And that corner of the heart that can be ethical is really beautiful. And to be inspired by that is meaningful. So the fifth one is generosity. And to be inspired or to recollect generosity. And here also, it's said to recollect your own generosity. So to recollect your own generosity, it helps if you were generous. So they say it's good to practice generosity, and it has a lot of benefits to you. Perhaps the benefits are more to you than to the person you give things to. But to be generous in all kinds of ways, and just with your time and your smiles and you know, your questions, how are you, and things like that. Many ways of being generous. But the word for generosity is chaga. And chaga also means relinquishment. And it's many people find it kind of strange that the word for generosity also means relinquishment. But the idea here about this kind of generosity is generosity that's not just kind of giving half-heartedly, but it's giving where you give yourself wholeheartedly, or you give completely freely of yourself. Here, take this, have this. There's no strings attached. There's no reluctance. Just here. And so that there's a relinquishment of any ways in which the gift that's given, any relinquishment of any way in which the gift is not completely freely given, handed over openly. And that is a beautiful thing, to feel something offered, and offered so freely and completely, nothing is asked in return. It's complete here, clean. Again, that first retreat that I sat in Thailand, there was a very meaningful moment, a few moments there. I was given a small kuti, a small meditation hut at the edge of the monastery, kind of far away from everybody else. And it was on top of I think it was more or less dried out then, but kind of on top of a swamp. And there was a long plank of wood that went on top of the swamp that, you know, didn't sink, but kind of that up to the kuti and the steps up to this hut I had on stilts. And every morning, early in the morning, the monks of the monastery would go out for their alms rounds. And they would come back with a lot of food for the monastery, more than they could eat. They would share it with the other people in the monastery, including me, at the meal at 10 o'clock. We don't have one meal at 10 o'clock. But I wasn't a monk, so I wouldn't go out for the alms round. I would just stay in my little kuti, little hut, and meditate. And so there I was meditating early in the morning inside. And after meditating for some time, I decided to get up, maybe do walking meditation outdoors. And so I got up quietly and I opened my door, and on the front, the little hut had a little porch. So these little steps coming up, there was this long, long series of planks of wood that went across this wet or swampy kind of area. And then it came up this flight of four or five steps, and then this porch, the covered porch, and then this little one-room little hut that I lived in. And so I opened the door, and on the top of the steps was an apple and some cookies or crackers or a little bit of, you know, snack food. So I saw it there, and then I looked up further, and at the far end of this long plank of woods, there was a monk who was walking away. And what struck me immediately was that the monk did not know I was going to open the door at that moment. And he had left his treats for me, his gifts to me, without any expectation that I'd ever know who he was. And that surprised me, being young and naive and whatever. So, wow, why would someone do that? And I was so inspired by that little act of freely given generosity. You know, it moved me. And down through time, over my adult life of practicing the Dharma, I'm deeply, deeply moved, you know, in ways that help me to trust life, trust letting go, trust the practice of Dharma by all the many people who have offered their support to me and to other people to practice. When I went to Asia to practice, when I was in Burma, I felt like it was just it would blow you away. It blew me away how amazingly generous the poor Burmese were for us Westerners who were practicing there. There's a kind of story that I think someone says, I forget, some English person writing about Burma wrote kind of a travel account from, I don't know, good number of years ago. He said he didn't realize that he'd eaten at someone's private home until he asked for the bill. Somehow he thought there was a restaurant, maybe because they had tables on a porch outside or something, and they came and just served him. And I kind of believe it, the way the Burmese are. Tremendously generous and supportive. And when I was in Burma, I knew that no matter what I actually needed, not what I wanted, but what I actually needed, if in order to be practice there, would be provided for me by the whole country. The best, you know, the doctors would come and see me in the monastery if I was sick. A dentist came to see me because my filling fell out. And he came to look at me and treat me. Never any request for money at all. Clothes, food, whatever we needed was provided freely. And the same thing in Japan. Same thing in Thailand. And same thing in this country. There's a tremendous amount of support that I received from so many people. And it was very moving for me to feel certainly people's support, but and how freely it was given, but also how it represented or helped me trust the practice of the Dharma. It helped me to trust that I could let go and devote myself and commit myself to the degree to which I did. So my life, you know, my adult life has been, you know, I feel like, you know, so much of what I've done in my life, I've been able to do because of people's generosity. I live in a world of generosity, and it moves me and inspires me, and this feeling of love and delight in this whole world that I live in has, you know, blossomed to a great degree because of this experience of generosity that I've had. And then the last of the recollections is the recollections in the devas, in the gods. Now, this is one that doesn't do much for me. So I'm not sure what to say, but when I try to make it do something for me, this is what I come to. Maybe some of you have a different approach. First, the idea in Buddhism is that in order to become a deva, you have to have a very high degree of ethical purity, and you have to live a pretty generous life. You can't end up as a god if you're miserly, and you can't get reborn as a god if you are unethical. And so, the recollection of the gods is kind of recollecting the great joy and happiness which is available in the next life if you live these ethical ways, these good ways. So that's nice, but if you don't believe in it, it's hard to be inspired by it. But what I see, the best I can do with these devas is I see them as being symbolic, representative of the unseen world of goodness, the unseen world of integrity, the unseen world of the way that generosity and love and kindness operate in our world. The devas we can't see, but there are ways in which the goodness that we live by somehow travels in unseen ways in this world around us. And, I don't always understand how it's going, how it's working, but I've many times felt and seen, been surprised by the different ways that goodness travels and comes back and circles and goes around and around. And so this unseen world is what the devas represent. And to be inspired by that, to kind of relax and just be settled. So these six recollections can be meaningful and nourishing for people, but they more than just nourishing. What the Buddha is saying is there's a way of taking these in. I would say take it into your heart, have it resonate with something inside of you. Maybe something you already know, but you recognize something in them. It isn't that they're foreign to who you are, but they somehow they reflect or mirror something that's true for you inside of yourself. And there's some way of opening the heart, taking it in, being informed in this deep inner way that can allow something to shift inside of you, which is radical, that brings you to a whole new way of living your life. A life that's not based on fear, a life that's not based on greed, a life not based on cultural expectations, familial expectations, but is based on these beautiful qualities, the beautiful possibility of freedom, of liberation, of profound peace and joy and well-being. A deep simplicity of being, costing nothing less than everything. As T.S. Eliot said. So, maybe for some of you, these six recollections are interesting. And the nice things about them is you can do it anytime. You can be sitting in traffic waiting for the traffic to move. And it might be better than some of the things you do. And don't underestimate the value of these things in times of crisis or at times when you're going to die. Maybe you won't have access to your breath. Maybe you won't have access to see where you're clinging, where you're holding on to when you're dying. Perhaps you can remember this, and in the remembering, something thaws, something can relax, something can settle. And let go. And if this talk tonight made no sense to you, or if it made sense but you don't like it, too religious, then you can leave it here with me. I'm happy to keep it here. So, thank you.